Is this about Seher? Are you thinking of getting married? He hesitated, so Rachel plunged in.
That doesn't have to change anything, sir. I'd be very happy for you.
Now, at last, Chatak smiled, the smile she knew, sweet and teasing, and the ramrod tension in her spine eased. It's not about Seher. I haven't spoken to her about this. I wanted to speak to you first. Rachel swallowed. She tried not to blink at the turn the conversation had taken.
You can talk to me, sir.
She tendered each word carefully.
You know that, I hope.
I do. Still, he hesitated, choosing his words. What happened at the mosque, what happened at the station, it reinforced something I've been considering. I don't know that I add value to this job anymore.
Is this because of your run-in with Diana?
He shook his head. No. She didn't say anything I haven't already heard from everyone. He looked defeated. Except you and Seher. We both saw a value in working from the inside. But Seher's not a prosecutor anymore, and I'm not sure that my future still lies with community policing. Very carefully, Rachel asked,
You're saying you think you haven't been effective?
His mouth twisted, and at the bitterness of his expression, Rachel's heart sank. I'm saying that it's hard for me to walk into a mosque where 12 individuals who share my faith have been murdered, most likely because they practice it, and do nothing other than stand back as a neutral observer. Rachel felt the tears well up in her eyes. Chatak swore softly.
Rachel? No, it's all right, sir.
She willed the tears not to fall, rubbing a quick hand across her eyes.
I'm fine. But how can you call yourself an observer? There's nothing neutral about you.
There isn't? He sounded disturbed.
No.
She forced a laugh.
Working with you, it's like seeing the mirror image of myself. You project neutrality, but you're ferociously committed to the work. Look how you stood up for Amadou. You forced that onto their agenda. You know you did that, right?
You're giving me too much credit. Lemaire doesn't strike me as a bigot. She scoffed at the explanation.
You don't give yourself enough. You've got more that you want to say, is that it? You can't take the pressure? The only senior brown cop? The only Muslim? Come off it, sir. What do you think it's like for me? For any woman who tries to slog her way to the top? You remember our first case? You remember Salvatore Costa?
A reluctant smile edged the corners of his mouth. Heartened by it, Rachel went on.
He was such a pig. Every single day he made a comment, just not loud enough for you to hear. Then one day I come in and he's got a nudie calendar tacked up on the board and he's watching for my reaction. Come on, Rachel, he says. Don't break a guy's heart. Stick your picture up there. You can be Miss January. Just you and a hockey stick, that would do it for me.
Seeing Rachel's face through the glass door of his office, Chatak had opened his door and taken in the scene. He'd ripped the calendar from the bulletin board in a single, concise gesture, turned to Sal, and said, Get your things and get out. You're no longer a member of this team. Then he'd looked around the room at the rest of them, Paul Gaffney, Declan Byrne, Rob Sharma, and he'd said in a tone that lowered the temperature in the room, If any one of you attempts to harass Sergeant Getty or any other female colleague, I will personally see to it that he's out of law enforcement. They'd looked at Chatak, guilty and embarrassed. They hadn't been part of it, but they'd allowed it to continue with their silence, a silence Sal had read as tacit endorsement. Chatak had called only Rachel into his office.
I know it's hard to fight this, Rachel, given what happened at your last post, but I wish you would. You'll have my backing and you won't have to face it alone.
She'd looked at him in horror, stammering an apology, and after seeing her panic, he'd let her escape and put the incident behind her. But the entire team had been required to attend training on the issue of harassment. A confidential reporting system had been established, but after Salvatore had left, there'd been nothing further for Rachel to report, at least not on her own team. In the field, there were always outliers, but Rachel's confidence had skyrocketed once she knew she had Khattak at her back.
You showed up, she said simply. You didn't just talk the talk, you made everything about being a cop better. You should know what a difference you've made.
They were at a crossroads. To the north of the bridge was the campus. To the south, the creek meandered off into the woods, while parallel to the road ran a set of train tracks, the mournful notes of the horn sounding from a great distance, adding pathos to the early dawn. Khattak cleared his throat. Rachel was glad he didn't thank her, because she didn't know how much longer she could swallow back her panic at the thought of him leaving her behind.
I think I'm failing, Rachel.
She wasn't buying that.
You're just angry. I think you've been angry for a while, but you've trained yourself not to show it.
She started up the car again, aiming a lopsided smile at Khattak. Startled at her words, he met her gaze. She couldn't help herself. Her whole heart was in her eyes. He swallowed at what he saw there, her personal faith in him. He reached out for her hand and squeezed it hard. Her voice, rough with emotion, she said,
Maybe it's time for a change.
Chapter 25. Squeezed in beside Khattak, who'd stretched out his long legs in front of him, Rachel sat back on the small sofa in the campus radio station, enjoying the warm rapport that existed between herself, Aliza, and Khattak, and into which Amadou Duchamp was now being inducted. She'd managed a few hours of sleep back at the hotel, and now she felt ready for the new day's challenges, though her worries about Khattak were gnawing at a corner of her mind. He didn't look like he'd slept all that well, though there was something about his good looks that was enhanced by the shadows under his eyes. She would have envied it, except that she knew he'd probably stayed up praying for the souls of the victims. She hoped he'd have a chance to rest later that afternoon. The campus studio was cozy. Aliza was seated behind the desk. Amadou wandered in and out of the sound booth, testing sound levels while Aliza fiddled with the microphone. One wall of the room was covered in a collection of vinyl records that made Rachel's mouth water. So many of her favorites were there. Bowie, Joni Mitchell, Blue Rodeo. They were crammed into a corner shelf at eye level, a little at odds with a wider selection of famous Quebecois singers and North African rye. Tacked to the back of the door of the sound booth was a signed Celine Dion poster, the singer posing in a shimmering gray mini-dress, her sincerity blazing from her eyes. Was it hanging there as some kind of cool campus kid mockery? Amadou met her gaze solemnly. With perfect seriousness, he said, She is still the queen. Rachel tried to seem like she agreed, though she unironically preferred the police.
You're okay? She asked Amadou, studying him. No after effects?
I'm okay.
His demurral was at odds with the weariness in his face.
A black man learns very early what to expect from police.
The words were neither bitter nor resigned. They spoke of matter-of-fact acceptance, belied by the gleam of resistance in his eyes, and despite her extensive training in community relations, Rachel couldn't think of a response that wouldn't come off as dismissive of Amadou's experience. She simply nodded, holding his gaze. She had thought that Aliza and Amadou would be at a vigil outside the mosque or at the hospital trying to get word on whether there were any survivors of the night's attack. She also thought that the shooting might have driven Aliza home to Waverly, considering the memories it must have brought back. Fists banged on the glass window of the studio. A look of disgust on her face, Aliza pushed the mic away and stood up, smoothing her hands against her jeans. It was Maxime Thibault who'd wrapped his fists against the glass, perhaps in a greeting, though the group of young men around him made obscene gestures at Amadou. Maxime's fixed stare didn't waver from Aliza. Slowly, he ran his tongue over his lips. She scowled in fury, but Khattak didn't let her intervene. He stepped outside, speaking too quietly for them to hear, but whatever he'd said, the young men moved off. As Khattak stepped back into the studio, Rachel caught the explicit racial slur aimed at his back. She wasn't surprised. Thibault had used an epithet to her face. Why would he spare Khattak? "You need protection from them." Khattak said this to both Amadou and Aliza. Her tone scornful, Aliza replied, "From a gang of preppy thugs? I don't think so." "No," Khattak shook his head decisively. "From Thibault. He's exhibiting classic signs of stalking, and that can escalate quickly." Amadou nodded wisely. "I've been telling her, sir. She doesn't listen." Aliza looked over at her friend, a sweet smile breaking on her face. "I have you, Amadou," she said simply. "You never let me out of your sight."
"Ya Allah."
He patted his chest once with his fist.
"Now you know why."
"We have to do the program today," Aliza explained. "It's more important than ever."
"Why?"
Khattak kept his eyes on her face, and she blushed. "You didn't hear the morning drive time? Pascal Richard is already sharing his crackpot conspiracy theories, riling people up. He's not the least bit apologetic for his role in this."
"Who's Pascal Richard?"
Aliza and Amadou answered together, feeding off each other's words.
"He's a local radio shock jock.
He's a cretin.
He's a monster. He's been fanning the flames of racial bias here since the passing of the Code of Conduct.
His following is enormous. His show has been syndicated and he's drawn all manner of crazies to this town. His shows are an example in incitement."
"Incitement to what?" Rachel broke in. She was thinking uneasily of the sections of Canada's federal criminal code that spoke directly to hate crimes. She hoped Aliza and Amadou weren't exaggerating the impact of a lone voice on the radio.
"To hate?" Aliza said. "To all the things that have happened here."
"The Wolf Allegiance's anti-Islam rally," Amadou supplied.
"The pig's head at the mosque."
"The attack on the synagogue."
"That time they set fire to the imam's car."
"It's endless. There's a new obscenity every day. I don't mean like the shooting last night. I'm talking about the little things that led up to it. That's why Aliza petitioned for her own radio show on campus, as a rebuttal to Pascal's, so we could take them on."
"I couldn't have done it without you, Amadou. You're the one who rounds up all the guests. You're the one who takes the call-in abuse."
"They abuse you too," Amadou said gently. "Just in a different way."
"It's much worse for you."
"Is it? Max is not after me."
"Amadou,
Aliza," he chided.
Their byplay reminded Rachel of one of her mother's favorite movies, His Girl Friday, where Cary Grant and Rosalind Russell had starred as a pair of battling journalists with snappy patter and rat-a-tat dialogue that had always delighted Rachel. In the case of the movie's two leads, the banter had been a means of expressing sparkling romantic interest. In Aliza and Amadou's case, it was the empathy of two friends who knew each other well and who could be counted on to have each other's backs. A little like Rachel and Khattak, which reminded her again of the conversation she'd had with Khattak in the car. She wondered whether she'd convinced him not to give up on their work. Without him, their unit would be left rudderless, and without much difficulty she could imagine it being dissolved. Khattak's quiet voice cut into her thoughts.
You said today's show is important. What are you planning for today?
An apprehensive note crept into Elise's voice. She fiddled with the microphone, avoiding Khattak's gaze.
We're having a memorial? By reading out the names of the victims from last night.
Khattak's eyes narrowed.
That information hasn't been made public because we haven't had time to notify all the victims' families. We're also waiting on news from the hospital, so how could you have a list?
Braving his gaze, Eliza answered.
Diana Shahada gave it to us. She didn't say that we couldn't use it. In fact, she's the guest on our show today.
Khattak looked over at Rachel, who squared her shoulders.
That's a terrible idea. We've been keeping a lid on things here so far. Speaking to Diana Shahada will only blow that up. You're not ready for that, Eliza. None of us are.
Eliza was wearing her hair in a long, dark braid. She leaned over the electronics board, and the braid fell forward. She was considering Rachel's words seriously. She'd grown up in the intervening years, a measured young woman who had taken time off from school to work after her sister's death, and who now had nearly completed her graduate degree. She seemed to be heavily involved, not only in her program of study, but also in a range of extracurricular activities that included the Muslim Students Association and her program on campus radio. What she had to say in response caused the hairs on the back of Rachel's neck to stand up.
That's what they said when we showed up to council meetings to make our position known on the code of conduct. When politicians refused to speak to us, they said we were stirring things up. It's what the police said when we reported Pascal Richard for hate speech, and then later, when we began to document each incident. Let's keep a lid on things. Let's not let them blow up. Well, they just blew up at our mosque.
Amadou moved closer to Eliza. He didn't touch her in any way, yet his solid presence was clearly a source of comfort. If it were Rachel, she would have hugged him, but through her work at community policing, she'd learned that observant Muslims did not engage in casual contact with members of the opposite sex. She'd seen as much with Khattak, until he'd lowered his guard with Seher, the woman he hoped to marry. She'd also seen him with Eliza, protective, the way he was with his younger sisters, but mindful of an appropriate distance. He wasn't as reserved with Rachel. She could tell that their relationship, as partners, as friends, fell into a different category in his mind, a category of one, where you could count on your partner to save your life as often as she spoke her mind. This was one of those times when Khattak would have to speak, and she wondered how closely his private thoughts might reflect Eliza's. But he was a law enforcement officer first.
No, I'm sorry. Even if Diana gave you the list, she has no way of knowing if it's accurate or up to date. It would be irresponsible to misinform the families. You know that, Eliza. It's not something I need to explain.
The fleeting pain that showed in Eliza's eyes was a quiet confirmation of his words. Amadou rapped his knuckles against the sound equipment. He was staring beyond Khattak's shoulder at the hallway where students had begun to line up at the glass, some waving at Amadou, others whispering and pointing. News about Amadou's detention had gotten out. Amadou ran his thumb over his lips. He didn't wave or smile or even fling up his head in a confrontational gesture. His quiet dignity spoke for itself as he met the gazes of the others head on. One by one, they dispersed. He shifted his attention to Rachel, taking her by surprise.
What did you think I would do?
Discomfited, she didn't answer.
What about the interview?
Eliza asked. Khattak considered it.
Diana Shahada usually finds a way to speak her mind. If you're not prepared for that, your interview might result in the same outcome. Do you think you can handle her?
Aliza smoothed her palms over her jeans before she answered.
We're mainly going to speak about the vigil.
She bit her lip.
There's a rumor that Maxime's followers are planning to stage some kind of rally. We want to make sure our vigil isn't disrupted.
Rachel thought that was a terrible plan. Won't drawing attention to their plans on public radio only encourage more of them to show up?
Aliza was quick to respond. It's not directed at them. It's an appeal to the rest of the citizens of Saint-Isidore to show up for the victims of the shooting.
From the way his brows drew together, Rachel could tell that Hattak was thinking the same thing that she was. The vigil would require police protection. If Etienne Roy was not the shooter, the suspect was still at large. And what better opportunity for the shooter to make his mark than by disrupting a peaceful vigil?
Even if we don't advertise it, people will still show up. This just allows us to do something to honor the memory of our friends.
Khatak's attention was distracted by the press of students on the other side of the glass. A few young men, tall, broad-shouldered, physically fit, were making obscene gestures at Amadou, who ignored them, going about the business of setting up the show. One was staring at Aliza with a fixed, unwavering gaze. Khatak turned back to the others. He spoke to Amadou.
You'll wait for me to attend the vigil. I'll escort you both personally.
Rachel watched as a silent communication passed between the two men.
We'll wait, he agreed.
He indicated the students on the other side of the glass with a sharp lift of his chin.
But what you're seeing out there is nothing new. It's not something you can protect us from after the two of you leave.
He made the possibility of their departure sound imminent, irreversible. Beneath his calm expression, Rachel sensed a very real despair. Had he been expecting more from them? Something he hadn't articulated because he didn't know how to put it into words.
You just have to deal with it. It happens every day.
Khatak shook his head, but he wasn't discounting Amadou's words or his experience. He was bringing them back to the matter at hand, the matter that was weighing on their minds.
Not like this, he said. A mass murder at a mosque is not something that happens every day, and God forbid it should ever happen again.
He turned on his heel suddenly and banged a fist on the glass, holding up his ID. The students quickly scattered.
Aliza, his tone was peremptory. You said you heard a rumor about Thibault's plans for tonight. Where? How did you hear it?
She didn't speak, fiddling with her braid, suddenly seeming much younger than her age.
It wasn't a request, Aliza.
Sparks flashed in the young woman's eyes. She wasn't used to this side of Khatak, and Rachel had to admit she hadn't had much experience of it either. He was cold, concise, focused, sparing little time for her feelings. Firming her lips, Aliza said,
It's not my secret to tell.
Khatak's gaze switched to Amadou, who shrugged.
Émilie Pilado warned me.
She's a student here. A glance passed between Amadou and Aliza. Then, with a hint of discomfort, he nodded.
But there was more to it.
Rachel had looked over the list of names Christian Lemaire had collected, family members and friends who were anxiously awaiting news at the hospital.
She was at the hospital last night, she put in. Is she related to one of the victims?
But she already had a sense of the answer.
She was with Chloe, right? One of the girls dressed in black.
They both nodded.
That seemed like something, Rachel pressed. The black clothes, Chloe desperate for news about Yusuf. Why were they there?
Why do they have an ear on the ground for trouble from Thibault?
Somewhat stiffly, Aliza answered.
The girls you saw last night? They have their own group. They call themselves the Lilies of Anjou. Sometimes they hang out with Maxime.
Rachel's eyebrows shot up. That wasn't quite the vibe she'd picked up from the girls at the hospital. They hadn't seemed anything like arm candy for a group of neo-Nazi thugs.
But Chloe is crazy about Yusuf. Why would she have any sympathy for Thibault?
Aliza hesitated.
Everyone on campus knows Max. He has a charming side, and he's really popular. People get drawn into that before they find out anything else. Once they do, it can be difficult to refuse his friendship, or to figure out a way to cut loose.
She sounded as though she knew something about the subject, as if it was a reason for her to stand by the young women she'd just described.
And Emily Pelado, Khatak interjected. The source of the rumor? What was she doing at the hospital?
Amadou's gaze fell to his hands. He answered with an air of palpable embarrassment, flicking Aliza a discomfited look.
We might as well tell the truth. Emily was there for me.
Chapter 26. Amadou gave them directions to the office of the dean of the university. Their conversation wasn't finished, but Lemaire had just called with an update. Rachel waited as Khatak listened to the other man on the phone, then laid out his own plans for the morning. Covering the phone with his hand, he spoke to Rachel.
Etienne Roy has given Lemaire permission to search both the church and his house for the handgun. He's asking if you want to go with him. He'll collect you on the way.
Surprised and a little disarmed, Rachel agreed, approving of the concise manner in which Khatak laid out his concerns. Khatak put his phone on speaker, treating Rachel to Lemaire's litany of curses. The vigil was the last thing they needed, but if they tried to shut it down outside the mosque, mourners would find another place to gather. He concurred with Khatak that they needed to mobilize an immediate response. When pressed on the safety of Amadou and Aliza, Lemaire advised that it was better to speak in person, after the team regrouped.
I'll meet you at the station in an hour, Khatak said, terminating the call.
Outside the dean's office, he asked Rachel to take out her notebook, rattling off a list of tasks that included setting up a meeting with the dean, another with Diana Shahada, and the task of tracking down Emily Pelado.
We need background on this group, the Lilies of Anjou. Also, I want a list of the incidents reported to the dean and the action the university took in response. When you have that list, get it to Diana Shahada and ask her to be at that meeting. Oh, and one more thing, Rachel.
Rachel looked up, her pen flying over her notepad.
Sir?
Make sure Gaff's settled in and connect him with Constable Benoit. There's a task I'll need him to do for me, but I don't have the evidence yet. Perplexed, Rachel stared at him. There was something about his expression that warned her not to inquire further.
What about you, sir? Where are you headed?
She tried to suppress the anxiety in her voice.
I'm going to see Pascal Richard.
Dismayed, Rachel said,
You won't be able to shut him down. It's a freedom of speech issue, sir.
She could tell that her boss was choosing his words with care, reminding himself that Rachel wasn't the enemy, that she wasn't responsible for the anger simmering just beneath his impassive exterior.
It's strange, isn't it, how much latitude hate is granted, the insidious way it creeps in under the protection of the law. People like Thibault are given the benefit of the doubt far more often than we are.
By we, he didn't mean police officers. It was obvious he meant members of minority communities, communities he identified with. Rachel couldn't fault his conclusions. Freedom of speech as a value was nearly sacrosanct, and under its broad umbrella,
Groups like the Wolf Allegiance had not only come into being, they were flourishing. Not a lot of consolation to the families of the dead. Had it crossed over, she wondered, speech into action, hate into blood. Khattak had used a similar phrase once when discussing the Christopher Drayton case, the case of a Bosnian Serb war criminal, a fugitive from justice who'd ended up in Canada. How quickly the violent ideals of ultranationalism led to hate, how quickly hate to blood. She struggled to clear her thoughts. This was Quebec, la belle province, not a distant land torn by a war fueled by nationalist identities. This was a blip, an anomaly, something that had happened once before with the shooting of young women at École Polytechnique, and now there was a new lone wolf, this one possibly radicalized online. She was convinced that the shooter would turn out to be a white male between the ages of 20 and 40 who was deeply disaffected, without genuine community ties, and who might have a history of domestic violence. This case was ugly because of the target. The shooter at École Polytechnique had targeted women engineering students, a different kind of ugliness, but it wasn't emblematic of the greater violence she was beginning to believe Khattak feared. Though she couldn't discount that it had happened in Saint-Isidore, or its infamous code of conduct, the code that may have been responsible for lighting the flame. Khattak was waiting for something more from her, but Rachel didn't know what else to say, so left it at, "Just be careful, sir. I bet this guy has a lot of experience riling people up. Don't let Richard mess with your head, sir. Don't let him get to you." Khattak's razor-sharp smile was thoroughly unsettling. "I'm the one who's planning to get to him." Leaving Rachel to team up with Lemaire, Khattak sorted through the details of the case in his mind, mentally arranging a list of questions to prioritize. The issue of first importance was not only to uncover the location of the missing handgun, but also to determine how two such weapons had fallen into the hands of the unknown shooter. Gun control laws in both the province and the nation were strict. The question of access to the weapons used in the shooting suggested a high degree of premeditation and a deliberate attempt by the shooter to cover his tracks. They were looking for a psychopath, perhaps. The executions in the basement of the mosque represented cold, controlled rage. But what of the upstairs shooting? The spray of bullets and the hate embodied in the message drawn on Youssef Soufiane's back. Still controlled, Khattak thought. Operating under pressure in a high-stakes environment, the shooter had kept his calm and exited from the scene safely. And if he was able to project himself as undisturbed by the night's events, if he was in some way celebrating them even now, that meant he might have the coolness of nerve required to return to the scene tonight to keep tabs on the investigation or to surveil the planned vigil. Even to attack again, if he was willing to accept the much greater risk of being caught. Who had the self-possession to carry out such an attack and also have access to a gun linked to organized crime? Khattak ran over a list of names in his mind. Roy and Amadou at the scene, Thibault or the Lilies of Anjou by implication, though he wasn't certain of the role either had played. As important as the timeline on the night of the shootings was the need for a timeline that tracked the incidents mentioned by Aliza and Amadou from the passing of the code of conduct to the shooting at the mosque last night. There had to be something there, a trigger they'd overlooked. And there was also the question of the role Pascal Richard had played, which reminded him of something he'd forgotten to ask Rachel. But better to go through Gaffney directly. Pulling into the parking lot at the radio station, he called Gaffney and explained what he wanted. It was mind-numbing, time-consuming work, but there was a reasonable possibility that Gaffney's efforts would yield a lead. He ended the call, following the directions to the third floor,
where Richard was busy in a program meeting. The receptionist pointed Khattak to a waiting area where a student intern crossed his path, a young man with a brush cut, dressed like another of Maxime Thibault's acolytes, but with an attitude of pleasant cooperation. Discovering that Khattak wasn't fluent in French, he switched politely to English. "Do you save the recordings of Monsieur Richard's call-in shows? On tapes or discs, I'm not sure of the technology involved." The intern, whose name was André Martin, nodded. "But they only go back as far as 6 months." Not long enough, Khattak thought, but it was a beginning. "I'll need those recordings. I'd appreciate if you'd have them delivered to my car." André's mouth gaped. He looked perturbed by the request. He'd guessed the connection between Khattak's request and the shooting last night at the mosque. "I'm not sure. I don't think I can decide that. You'd have to ask my boss." Khattak gave him a quizzical glance. "Do you think he might have some reason to refuse?" Now André seemed truly alarmed, stumbling over his words as he searched for an appropriate response. Surprising Khattak, he answered at last. "If the reason you're asking is because of last night, I think he'd mind very much." He cast a furtive glance behind him at the door. "Pascal is not the type to take the blame for anything on his own shoulders." With a sudden flash of perception, he added, "He's not smart enough to understand the obvious. It's all a game to him." Khattak watched the young man closely. "It's not a question of conviction, then, nor of deep-rooted ideology." André didn't hesitate. "Not at all." He gestured expansively at the closed door. "Pascal is a clown." "And yourself?" Khattak canvassed the young man's haircut and clothing again. "Would you say you subscribe to a particular set of convictions?"
"What do you mean?"
"You work for Monsieur Richard," Khattak said. "You're sporting a certain form of dress. It's suggestive." André swallowed, his large Adam's apple bobbing in his throat. He looked as though he were about to cry, a sensitivity at odds with his appearance.
"No matter what Pascal stands for, this is a good internship, a step up the ladder for me. I don't share Pascal's views, whatever his actual views may be, and I can assure you I'm not one of Thibault's wolves. I'm a military cadet. A certain professionalism is expected."
The door behind André opened, and very much on his dignity, he excused himself from Khattak's presence. In other circumstances, Khattak would have been abashed and offered the young man an apology. In this case, he didn't. He was weighing André's denial against his unexpected revelation. As a military cadet, André would have had extensive training in the use of firearms. Pascal Richard leaned back in his chair, stretching his arms out behind his head, blocking the view from a suite of windows. And what a view it was! Perched above the lake, framed by a blossoming forest of maples and alders, where the cool gray water rolled over a stony ground in an undulating rhythm, the picture window opened onto a terrace that was set with a bistro table and matching chairs. A window nearly as large on a perpendicular wall gave him a view into the next door studio, where a different broadcast was airing. From a wall of windows, the studio shared the spectacular view of the lake and the wraparound outdoor terrace. With its framed vanity photographs and awards and impeccably chosen furniture, the interior of Richard's office was immaculate. Khattak wasn't sure what he'd been expecting. A senior figure who may have served as a mentor to Maxime Thibault, well-groomed and self-possessed, perhaps, or a loud, brash personality along the colorful lines of Canadian icon Don Cherry. Instead, Pascal Richard more closely resembled Cherry's longtime counterpart on Hockey Night in Canada, the likable Ron McLean. Richard wore a pinstriped shirt with cufflinks. His brown hair had a natural wave and was worn loose and long in the front. His attractive face was permanently creased with laugh lines, and he looked Khattak over with an unconcealed and vivid interest. He was fluently bilingual, and the resonant timbre of his voice was perfectly suited to his work. He didn't look anything like Khattak's conception of a purveyor of mainstream hate, but appearances didn't mean anything, as Khattak had learned again during his last case, investigating two murders on the Greek islands. He skipped over the preliminaries and asked Richard to provide an account of his actions the previous evening, curious to see the man's response to a direct approach.
"You think I carried out the shooting?"
"Did you?"
"Hell no."
He gestured at a trophy on his desk in the shape of an oversized microphone.
"That's the only weapon I require."
Khattak found this answer revealing.
"Who do you consider your enemy, Monsieur Richard?"
He rested his arms on Richard's desk, a tactic designed to encroach on Richard's territory.
"Who are you armed against?"
To his surprise, Richard mimicked the gesture, leaning in close enough for Khattak to smell his aftershave, woodsy and pleasant like Richard. He took his time looking Khattak over, a wicked spark in his eyes.
"Not who you're imagining," he said easily. "Not someone like you."
Khattak was caught off guard by both the implied intimacy of the remark and the suggestion that Richard had recognized him. Richard seized his advantage.
"Come on,"
he said with a grin.
"You're famous, Inspector Khattak. You have a legion of female fans. Maybe some men, too. Meeting you in person, I see why."
It was a flirtatious comment, offered by a man with considerable charm of his own. Issa wondered if Richard thought he would be rattled by the other man's interest. He wasn't, though he shifted back in his chair.
"Look," Richard continued, "I'm deeply sorry about what happened at the mosque, but it is in no way connected to my program or to me. I was at a bar last night, having a drink with friends from work."
Khattak remembered André.
"Is your intern old enough to drink?"
"Who? André? Yes, he's old enough. We invited him along."
"Was he with you the entire night?"
"The entire night?"
There was a swift spark of interest in Richard's eyes.
"I couldn't say for certain. Everyone has their own thing. Pool, darts, chatting up someone who shows an interest. He came with us. I'm not sure when he left."
He noted down the names of Richard's prospective alibi witnesses, but when Richard went on to specify time and location, it left a window open, not only for André, but also for Richard himself, and he wondered if the man realized that. In a crowded bar, it would have been easy to slip away and return later, or simply to have gone on home, as Richard admitted to doing himself. He made a mental note to ask Lemaire to follow up on the activities of both men.
"Now, if someone like you had been there, I might have found it worth my while to stick around."
When Khattak ignored this, Richard challenged him directly.
"Are you a homophobe?"
It was Khattak's turn to offer a smile of some charm.
"Not at all."
"Well, I'm not an Islamophobe."
Richard said this with manifest aggression.
"Your program suggests otherwise."
"Can you specify a particular program?"
Khattak's phone signaled the arrival of a text message. He ignored it for the moment.
"What about this morning's?
I understand that you invited your callers to share their theories about who was behind the shooting."
"So?"
"Monsieur Richard,"
Khattak's voice deepened with a note of warning.
"You focused on Amadou Duchamp."
Richard rose to his feet in a sudden motion. He ambled over to his vanity wall,
stopping before a photograph of a ceremony. In it, he was being handed the key to the city by the mayor of Saint Isidore.
"Not me," he clarified. "The police did. Your colleagues, I believe. I just ran with it."
Khatak rose too. "Are you not at all concerned about inciting violence against a young man who bravely ran to the scene to offer his aid to the wounded? Or were you unaware of that?"
Richard turned from the wall, and Khatak noticed that the collar of his shirt was drawn up unusually high at the back, a slight misstep in an otherwise polished appearance.
"I thought he was in police custody."
"Did you?"
Khatak pointedly fell silent, pushing the door to Richard's office ajar. The sound of a radio broadcast filled the hallway. It wasn't Richard's station. It was Amadou's rich voice in the midst of an interview with Diana Shahada.
"You're paying attention to campus radio, an unlikely rival for a man in your position, which suggests that you thoroughly understand the dubious achievements of your program. Some would call it incitement."
Richard's eyes flicked over Khatak again, making a personal calculation.
"Would you?" he asked.
"That depends. I'd like to borrow your recordings so I can make that determination for myself."
For a moment, he thought Richard would refuse. Instead, the other man shrugged.
"You're welcome to them. I've no doubt that Amadou and his feisty counterpart have your ear, but you won't find evidence of incitement on my show. And even if you do, incitement isn't a crime."
Some types of incitement were, Khatak thought. He studied the photograph that had drawn Richard's interest. He recognized several faces in it, including those of Christian Lemaire and Isabelle Clément. His mind drew connections that left him shaken. The three figures in the photograph represented law enforcement, politics, and the press, and they had deemed Pascal Richard's program worthy of honoring with the key to Saint Isidore. He was reminded of something Eliza had once written him, something she had adopted as her motto. "The battle is everywhere, all the time."
"You have a platform," he told Richard quietly. "Some would say that it confers a moral responsibility."
Richard shrugged this off. "I'm not the voice of public morality. Ratings, dollars, entertainment, that's the business I'm in."
Grimly, Khatak said, "There's a direct connection between your business and what happened at the mosque last night."
Richard took offense at the words.
"That's a pretty big leap. There's a difference between letting people air their grievances on my show and some lunatic setting out to gun down innocent people."
Khatak knew different. "I'm afraid it's not as great of a leap as you think."
He clarified certain details about the nature of Richard's program. Richard made arrangements for André to deliver the recordings to police headquarters with the air of a man who had nothing to hide and less still to apologize for. Unconvinced, Khatak thanked him for his time, but at the door, Richard detained him by voicing another question, his tone clipped, the words hesitant. Issa looked up from his phone. He hadn't had a chance to read through his messages yet.
"Would you like to get a drink with me tonight? It doesn't have to be alcohol."
Without a trace of discomfort, Issa declined the request.
"I'm afraid it would be inappropriate."
Richard moved closer, his eyes on Khatak's face.
"Because of your investigation?"
Khatak nodded.
"That, and the fact that I'm hoping to be married soon."
He checked his messages on his way to the car, an update from Rachel on which of the tasks he'd assigned that she'd been able to accomplish, and some cryptic muttering about Lemaire taking her to check out Père Etienne's church,
which for the moment he ignored. There was another message waiting for him through a new delivery service. He clicked it open as he stepped into the sunlight. He looked back at the building to find Richard watching him through the window. He was struck by a pang of menace. It wasn't because of Richard. It was as a result of the message waiting for him on his phone. Richard doesn't want you nearly as much as I do. This time, Issa remembered to take a screenshot. Chapter 27. Pascal Richard's satellite radio show, translated from the French. Richard.
So you guys hear about this group of goth girls here in Saint-Isidore? First, I thought they were Allegiance groupies. Turns out, no. No wolf heads for them, just delicate little pansy lilies on the insides of their wrists. That's how you spot these bad girls. They call themselves Lilies of Anjou. Posers or not, you decide. One of them is pretty sweet. Let's call her M. So this M chick is all hot and bothered about some biracial newcomer. He doesn't look biracial, mind you. He's blacker than the inside of a coal mine, but she doesn't care. She's after him day and night. The fact that he's at the scene of the shooting, he's arrested, none of that puts her off. What can I tell you? Some girls like to roll in the mud. Now let me tell you the good part. This dude, this black-as-night hombre from the gateway to hell, he doesn't want her. He's not assimilating, my friends. He doesn't speak French. He speaks some shit-for-brains patois, whatever passes for la langue française in that Senegalese backwater he's from. So why is that a problem? I think you know the answer to that. These people, the ones who won't let a woman show her face, they don't want to be Québécois because they think they're goddamn superior. We're the cockroaches, my friends. Don't let anyone tell you different. Okay, Marie, who do we have on the line?
We have Paul on the line.
I've seen the way the lilies go after those guys. Those guys will fuck them, no problem. But then they go home to Maman for a sweet little virgin.
Sounds like you could use a sweet little virgin yourself.
Va chier, Pascal. Fuck you.
Yeah, probably.
But they're throwing themselves at these guys. They should be wearing burkas.
You'll get no argument from me. You part of the Allegiance.
Better if I don't say.
I wouldn't worry, man. They get some excellent pussy.
Fucking A.
Wait, man, help me out here. You said guys, plural. It's not just M and the black guy? Who else is getting their panties in a wad?
That little dopey chick? She's pretty in a crack addict way.
I love me some heroin chic.
Exactly, dude. But I'm guessing she's out of luck now. One of them's out of circulation.
You talking about that kid in the hospital, Youssef Soufiane? That's cold, dude.
I'm just saying what you're saying. We're the cockroaches, man.
You want to drive them out, you better be there to put pressure on the mayor. You better have rung the phone off the damn hook on the code of conduct.
Don't worry. We've got it covered.
Hangs up.
Marie, I gotta say that kid was lit. Who's gonna compete with that?
How about someone who thinks you're shit? We have Reg on the line.
You know who's a shit for brains, Richard? You. You're like primordial sludge that never crawled out of the sea.
What's the matter, babe? You've got no arguments, so you resort to, what do you libtards call it, ad hominem attacks.
You're a sexist, misogynist, racist piece of shit. You're inciting violence by demonizing our neighbors. You would have fit right in Nazi Germany.
Ooh, fancy college girl with college words. You go to the Université Marchand? Hey. I know who you are. You're the ugly lily. You're the dyke, Réjeanne Baudouin. You still there, bitch? Sorry, I meant butch.
Did you just out me on your program, you homophobic fuck?
I thought you libtards were all about owning who you are. All that gender fluid, non-conforming crap. Girl power. But be honest. Are you a girl, or are you one of those freaks in between?
You would know.
Heard you hit on Hatak. You know who he is, right? The Muslim cop they sent to clean up your mess?
Is that your fantasy, freak? Or do you have a crush on someone at Al-Salam, like both of your horny friends?
You're a walking charter violation, and you're a fucking awful Quebecois.
Walking charter violation, that's a good one. But freedom of speech, babe, freedom of speech. Or don't they teach you that at the school of libtards?
They teach us to recognize Nazis. You're a danger to everything we stand for.
Call terminated.
That was a live one, friends. Sounds like our friend Rejan needs a good old-fashioned screw to loosen up everything that's tight. I know she's a dyke, but let's hope our brothers in the Allegiance are willing to take one for the team.
Chapter 28. With Hatak busy at Richard's studio, Rachel accompanied Lemaire to Père Etienne's church for a preliminary search. The old stone church had been built in the late 1800s. It was too circumspect and discreet to be considered a cathedral, built on a smaller plan without the requisite connecting galleries or stone buttresses. Its rose-gold stone was wrapped in curling tendrils of ivy and warmed by bright swaths of sunlight. The garden was overgrown with tiger lilies that swayed in the breeze under a surfeit of hedges. It was poised at the summit of a modest hill, and something about its character suggested a place of sanctuary, of homecoming. Rachel had stopped attending church the third year after her brother Zach had run away. Her parish priest had had nothing to offer her by way of hope except the empty promises of a distant, saving grace. The priest's bond with Rachel's father had been too strong for him to question why Zach had run away or to ask what there might have been in the home to drive a teenage boy away. His charity didn't extend to Rachel. He'd made her feel as though her concerns were a nuisance and that she would be better off submitting to her father's authority. But Père Etienne's church was nothing like that cold space that had seemed to condemn Rachel's sorrow, mocking her despair with the lonely silence of judgment. Someone was playing the organ with a light hand, the music evoking the dance of spring, budding life, intemperate joy. The worn oak benches gleamed gold in the chapel light, the end of each pew dressed charmingly with wildflowers. At the altar, someone had potted pink and gold chrysanthemums in a pale blue jug. There were no calla lilies, and none of the flowers were white. The jewel-toned rose window threw arrows of blue and green light over the altar and down across the transept. The entire scene was resonant with hope.
It is a beautiful church, Christian Lemaire said, observing Rachel's reactions. You are a Catholic?
I think so, Rachel said cautiously.
You don't know?
There was warmth in the blue eyes that regarded her, but Rachel didn't think Lemaire was mocking her. She had climbed the three stairs to the chancel, and now she placed both hands on Père Etienne's lectern to give herself time to answer.
Whether it's a mosque, a church, or a synagogue, I don't see God stepping in to help. Look at last night's shooting.
She was standing in a spot where the rose window cast a shaft of orange-gold light over her hair. The wisps of hair at her neck spiraled out in fiery trails. When she noticed Lemaire staring at her, she quickly stepped out of the light. He turned away, gesturing at the organ loft above the chancel, where the church's pipe organ was fixed in glorious display. They couldn't see the organist from where they stood, but the music continued without a break, swelling up into the grand emptiness of the nave.
"We should cover every inch of this place," he said.
Rachel was dubious. Though the church was modestly built, it suggested any number of places to hide a weapon, and that was excluding the garden. She moved away from the lectern.
"Would you mind beginning with our local musician?" Lemaire asked.
"Any particular reason why?"
Lemaire came closer,
looking down at her from his great height. Did he resent being challenged, or did he just not like explaining himself? She hadn't gotten that vibe from the way he'd singled Benoit out for praise among a group of more experienced colleagues. She faced him squarely, waiting.
The musician is a young woman. She might relate better to you.
Rachel had no idea what prompted her to challenge Lemaire. She should have asked him how he knew the organist. Instead, she offered,
"You don't think you have what it takes?"
Her words were rude and uncalled for, but Rachel was more appalled to hear the note of flirtation in her voice. A scalding blush climbed to the roots of her hair. From the hint of devilment in Lemaire's eyes, he was thoroughly enjoying her embarrassment. He didn't lean in to crowd her. He just waited an appreciable moment before he said,
"You tell me."
The heat blazing through Rachel became an inferno. She could feel herself perspiring under her navy blue shirt. She struggled to regain her composure, blinking several times rapidly and running a dry tongue over her lips.
"Christ, sir, I'm sorry. That was completely out of line."
Lemaire's pleasant laugh sounded in the nave.
"Rachel."
He shook his head, still enjoying her discomfiture, but not in a manner that amplified her humiliation. He was sharing the humor of the moment with her.
"You don't need to call me sir. I'm not your boss. I'm your temporary partner, a colleague, maybe a friend. If you can't bring yourself to call me Lemaire, perhaps you might try Christian. You don't mind if I call you Rachel?"
He moved a short distance away, finding a small door that Rachel had missed and turning its iron knob. Rachel took a few calming breaths. He'd put the control back in her hands, not pressuring, not insisting, just suggesting another way of looking at things. At him. He'd said nothing out of line in return, merely teasing her a little, the way that Hattak sometimes did. Except her reaction to Lemaire was nothing like her response to Hattak, whom she'd come to think of as the truest friend she'd ever had. With Lemaire, there was something more, a hint of excitement, and if she didn't ruthlessly squash it down, a growing sense of attraction. Realizing she'd been silent too long, she nodded.
"Yes, you can call me Rachel."
She slipped under his arm to open the door. It led to a narrow staircase that would take her up to the organ loft. She was unsettled by the thought that Lemaire might be watching her climb and wondering why he'd preferred to search the nave and transept himself. He couldn't be covering for Père Étienne, or he wouldn't have suggested the search to begin with. She should feel flattered that he'd asked her to partner him. Instead, she felt somewhat cautious. Was he keeping an eye on what she and Hattak were up to? Or was this a means of ensuring that Hattak was out there on his own? She couldn't say the inset team was hostile to their presence, but no one had laid out the welcome mat either, except for Christian Lemaire. Rachel shook her head at herself. Damned if he did, damned if he didn't. Maybe she should cut him a little slack. At the top of the stairs, she peered over the railing to watch him search. He'd begun at the last pew and was thorough in his methods, checking every hymnal, each footrest, the spaces beneath the loosely cushioned benches, the collection boxes stacked at the outer end of each row. So he wasn't faking it. He was really looking for the gun, despite his treatment of the priest. She was beginning to think she understood it, connecting it to her own experience at her parents' Catholic church. Their priest had wielded influence, even amidst that small congregation. In a place like Saint-Isidore, where the institutions of power seemed inextricably linked, the relationship with Père Étienne might be one that it was necessary to preserve.
"Who are you?"
A sharp, sardonic voice interrupted Rachel's reflections. The flowing music had ceased.
The organist who asked the question was not who Rachel had expected to find playing such evanescent music. It was one of the three girls who'd been at the hospital, the one with short black hair that was sleek and glossy, dyed neon blue at the tips. She had a pointed, unmade-up face and a skin like thick Irish cream. She was still wearing the black coat, the collar tacked straight up. Rachel noticed now that a series of Baroque antique silver pins had been substituted for buttons on her coat. A silk scarf at her throat in a blaze of vermilion completed her ensemble. The girl was an original. She was also beautiful, but not in a conventional sense. It was something about her expression, the sheer force of life contained in her vivid blue eyes. She watched Rachel with an expression of skepticism, and she must have deduced who Rachel was because she'd spoken in English with a strong Quebecois accent. Rachel answered the girl in French and asked her name in turn.
Réjean Baudouin, I'm a student at the Université Marchand.
You're local? Rachel asked, wondering why she was persisting with her French when the girl was answering in English. Réjean nodded. She straddled the bench, resting one hand on the keys. Strong hands, Rachel saw, and the right hand was shadowed, the blue and green tints of a bruise showing at her knuckles.
For my sins, yes.
Why do you say that?
You have to ask.
It was an oblique reference to the shooting, to the chaos that was expanding to claim all of Saint-Isidore. Maybe that's why Réjean was at the church, losing herself in the transcendent music she had played.
What hymn was that?
Rachel asked. She was deeply interested in music, the legacy of being the daughter of Lillian Getty, an aspiring concert pianist who had retired upon her marriage to Don Getty. Rachel knew a lot of church music, but she hadn't recognized the piece Réjean had played.
Nothing you know?
Listening to the girl's sharp, uncooperative responses, Rachel had a better sense of why Lemaire had suggested she conduct the interview. She leaned against the railing.
It wasn't a hymn, really. I'd call it Concerto of Spring. It was bursting with hope, but it was tender beneath its energy.
Réjean looked at Rachel more closely.
You play, she said.
I'm learning, Rachel smiled. My mother was a pianist. She taught me a little about music, but I can't play anywhere near as well as you. She tipped her head back to catch the fragments of light the rose window scattered over the organ. She had a sense of being suspended out of time, in a place of utmost harmony. She wished Réjean would take up the music again.
I'm a music student, Réjean said after a pause. That was my own composition.
Rachel looked back at her, alert.
It was beautiful.
She considered the girl's age.
You must be some kind of prodigy.
Réjean didn't smile, but her expression lightened. Her free hand played with her scarf.
Not really, she said. I hear the music, of course, but it's been a lifetime of grueling study.
If you have a keyboard, you should play that at the vigil.
That's not how Muslims conduct their mourning.
The words took Rachel by surprise. They suggested an intimacy with the Muslim community that Rachel hadn't expected from Réjean. Another assumption, despite the fact that she and Khattak had been advised that the members of the Lilies of Anjou knew Youssef and Amadou. She reconsidered, sharpening her focus.
You were at the hospital last night. Did you know any of the victims of the shooting? Is that why you were there?
I was there for my friends. They wanted to be there.
I talked to your friend, Chloe. She was anxious to know about Youssef Soufiane's condition.
Who wouldn't be?
Réjean was fencing with her.
Were you?
Of course, I'm a human being. Don't let the get-up fool you.
She shook her hair out of her eyes,
caressing the neon blue tips with thin white fingers. Is that the only reason you were there? To support Chloe? Rejan's eyes blinked, cat-like. No. There was also Amadou to worry about. Emily was worried about him. But not you, not personally. A private smile etched Rejan's lips. Not personally. Men don't interest me. She paused, waiting to see if Rachel had drawn an inference from her words. She ran her hand lightly over the organ's keys. What interests me is music, nothing else. Not quite nothing, Rachel pointed out. If you were at the hospital, if you know something about Muslim funeral customs, your friends must matter to you.
Of course they do.
She turned back to the organ, rearranging her posture and her limbs, bringing her hands to the keys. A gentle refrain floated through the alcove, evocative of longing and loss. Rachel scanned the alcove as Rejan played, searching for places where someone might have hidden a gun. Apart from the organ and the bench Rejan was sitting on, there were no repositories in the alcove, no additional places she could search. Unless there was a way of dropping the weapon inside the organ's wind chest. She put the question to Rejan. How does the organ sound this morning? Rejan fingered the keys beneath her hand. Fine. Sublime. Like it's only been waiting for the morning to come alive. A dead end there, then. But Rachel would still check. Addressing the girl's back, Rachel said, Where were you last night after 9 p.m.? She received an answer she wasn't expecting. The girl turned the melody dark, casting a glance at Rachel over her shoulder. I was in the woods.
The woods?
Alone at night? A stroke of apprehension shivered down Rachel's spine. I didn't say I was alone. I was with my friends, deep in the woods, far away from the mosque. I don't know if it would have been better or worse to have been there. Rachel refused to be distracted, though the shape the music had taken, dangerous and disturbing, was giving her a feeling of queasiness. What were you doing in the woods? Practicing a ritual? The girl's hands froze on the keys.
Why would you ask that? Being fond of nature doesn't make me some kind of witch.
It was Rachel's turn to score a point.
No, you're not, are you? You're a lily of Anjou. I'm just not sure what that is.
She let the silence build. It served a purpose. No matter how poised this gifted musician was, she couldn't be certain her secrets were safe from a detective. Everything Rachel asked her had a point to it. Rejan revealed things even when she withheld information. As Rachel waited for a response, she moved to the side of the organ, peering at its pipes.
What are you doing?
Rejan asked sharply, the music coming to a close. Rachel looked at the girl, her face spattered with droplets of light, soft and expressive with sympathy. Her words were a sharp contrast. I'm trying to determine who murdered 12 people last night. Rejan raised a hand to her throat, her wrist twisted outward. The same tattoo that had stamped Chloe's wrist was delicately etched on her skin. She hadn't thought of it before, but now Rachel considered the meaning of Youssef Soufiane's knife wounds and the fact that someone had taken the time in the midst of pandemonium to carve that emblem onto Youssef's skin. The fleur de lis again. What had Rejan and her friends been doing in the woods at night? And what were the rituals of the lilies of Anjou? Chapter 29. Rejan denied any further knowledge of events and refused to explain her activities in the woods. She slipped away down the staircase without a backward glance, pausing only to collect a coffee-colored satchel that thumped against her leg. When Rachel examined it more closely, Rejane hitched it over her shoulder and fled. Why? What was in the bag that Rachel couldn't know about? Frowning, she turned her attention to the bench. It was expensive, padded with oxblood leather, but it didn't open. In fact, the bench was locked. Rachel would need to find the key. Perhaps it was in Père Etienne's office. She'd have to look for it to rule the bench out as a hiding place for the gun. That left the organ itself. Maybe there were openings at the tops of the pipes. Some of them were large enough that an object could have fit inside, but Rachel couldn't reach the top of the wind chest from the floor. She moved the bench closer to the organ. It was better, but not ideal. She had to perch on her tiptoes to reach the top.